Funding for THINK comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to THINK on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Is money alone enough to solve the problems of the modern world? While cash gifts to charitable organizations clearly can set good things in motion, many experts now believe that the most effective philanthropists are those that commit other resources as well, including their time, energy, and expertise. And organizations that partner up to share the work of solving social problems are often the most successful of all. John Kenya is managing director of the nonprofit consulting firm FSG, and he's co-author, along with Leslie Crutchfield and Mark Kramer, of the new book Do More Than Give, The Six Practices of Donors Who Change the World. John, welcome to THINK.
Hi, Chris. Delightful to be here. Thank you.
One of the things you stress is that large-scale social change also often demands something called collective impact. Can you talk about what that means?
Sure. Well, collective impact essentially is thinking about a specific social issue. It might be homelessness. It might be watershed restoration. It might be kindergarten through 12 education reform. And select that issue and try to align and coordinate the actions of all the players who are actually addressing that issue. So nonprofits, philanthropy, government, even faith-based organizations, and trying to align what in some instances is tens of organizations, in some instances actually might be hundreds of organizations to be moving in the same direction to actually achieve large-scale change as opposed to more sort of smaller-scale change.
So you talk about government, you talk about nonprofit, you talk about faith-based organizations. That all sounds great. It also sounds like a lot of different languages being spoken about the problems to be solved and the approaches to take to solving them.
Yeah, I think you know that is the one of the biggest challenges that we face when we talk about addressing social and environmental issues is that on the one hand, often the assumption has been that, say, it's education, that's the realm of just the schools, or environmental issues, that's just the realm of nonprofits who work on the environment. But if you look at any of the serious social problems of our time, they, in fact, will require the action of all different sectors to get involved. And you're exactly right that they do speak different languages, and that's a critical issue, which is why it's so important as we think about sort of large-scale changes, we think about what we call collective impact, that one of the first steps is that you come together to actually create a common agenda for what you're seeking when you approach change.
And it doesn't necessarily mean that everybody has to have exactly the same goals.
Well, it does mean that at sort of a high level that the organizations that are involved need to actually buy into the same common agenda. It doesn't mean that they're all going to be performing just against that. Let me give you an example. So there's a really wonderful example that we've researched in Southern Virginia on the Elizabeth River called the Elizabeth River Project. And what this this effort has done has brought together over hundreds of organizations to essentially restore the Elizabeth River watershed area, which 15 years ago when this initiative was started, you had basically a dead river. There was nothing that could live in it, plant or fish, and completely polluted. And hundreds of organizations took it upon themselves to create an 18-point plan in terms of how they would actually address restoring the river. And so there was one particular organization called the Elizabeth River Project at this point that actually brought together four municipalities, brought together the EPA, Environmental Protection Agency, brought together the U.S. Navy, dozens of businesses, lots of community organizations and schools and universities to basically do their part to actually improve the river. And today, 15 years later, we're actually looking at, they've been able to conserve or restore 1,000 acres around this watershed. They've actually been able to remove 251 million pounds of pollution, and they actually have been able to reduce the carcinogens in the water. So at this point, they have, I think, something like 27 different varieties of fish that are actually in the river in a way that they didn't before. So all of these organizations in and of themselves weren't saying, okay, this is all we're going to do, but they all signed on to this 18-point plan and are participating creating and delivering parts of it.
And then they divide out the labor according to what they're really good at.
That's right. That's mm-hmm. right. So you have, you know, in this particular instance, you have a set of organizations within the nonprofit sector that are working on working directly with residents and individual citizens to sort of create public will around, you know, ways that they can address pollute less and ways that they can address in terms of improving the river. You have a set of organizations that are actually interacting directly with business, because business obviously plays a big role, both in terms of the pollution that they're doing and both in terms of what they can do to ameliorate the situation. And then, of course, something like this requires a lot of measurement and sort of scientific work in terms of sort of addressing the improvements in the area. So you have a third set of organizations in this particular instance working around that. So to your point, not everybody is doing the same thing. They're actually focusing on areas that they're good at and where they can make a difference.
So when you talk about different organizations that have similar goals, they want to work together on something, I would imagine that at least on the nonprofit side, there are a number of organizations that are used to competing for funding.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. So that's definitely an issue. And I think, you know, one of the things we talk about when we talk about collective impact is that organizations, nonprofits, and also, and I'll talk a minute about foundations and funders and corporations who contribute, they need to get into the mindset, into the mode of creating credibility for their efforts versus taking credit. And I think as we found in our research, one of the you know, the primary reasons why collective impact is not taking place, and in fact what we see and what we talk about is sort of a paradigm of isolated impact mm-hmm. that's taking place in the nonprofit sector today, is individual organizations go their own way. And yeah, you know, they're each raising their individual funding. What we talk about when we say collective impact has to happen and in terms of the conditions that are required is that individual nonprofits, you know, it's important for them to develop evidence that they're actually successful and they do need to use that in fundraising, but they can use that in a way that they're able to influence what actually happens. So there are times when they're going to need to sort of toot their own horn. There are other times if they're advocating for changes in policy where they'll be much better when they're working with the collective. We also see in this whole issue of sort of taking credit that many within the funding community, foundations, corporations that have philanthropic investments, you know, are very interested in getting sort of name brand recognition mm-hmm. For their particular efforts, and that actually does fight against this notion of collective impact, and that you know, we need to step back from that. We need to think more holistically about the roles that can be played and what needs to be funded if collective impact is actually to happen.
So when you're deciding that you want to have a collective impact and you have, you know, several organizations that agree with you and you want to sort of open up the doors to more, do you just put out the call? Are there, do you have to select really carefully and perhaps leave some organizations out that may mean well but wouldn't be a good fit?
Yeah. So how do these things get catalyzed and how do they happen? And I think the answer to that is that there's no real recipe. In general, what we've seen in communities is that there's a sort of an objective and well-trusted party that has the ability to bring people to the table that gets things to happen. They're able to convene, you know, initially a set of players that they think will you know, should be involved in the issue and, you know, gradually sort of expand out involvement. It happens in all different ways. The Elizabeth River Initiative I was talking about was started by an individual activist, Marjorie Mayfield Jackson. And she was able to actually just through force of will and personality, and she wasn't alone. She had some collaborators bring people together. In other instances, it may be a local foundation, a local funder. The Communities Foundations of Texas here has been a very effective convener because I think they're trusted and pretty well known within in the social sector here in terms of bringing folks together.
One of the things you've talked about here is the importance of a backbone organization.
Yeah.
Is that the sort of role that the Communities Foundation performs?
It could. So we do talk about sort of a number of different conditions that bring about collective impact. And I think one of the things I should point out is that when you think about sort of you know, making progress against social issues, again, whether or not it's education or poverty reduction, homelessness, climate change, that, you know, there have been collaborations for years. Collaborations have been around for a long, long time. And the unfortunate thing is that the bulk of them actually have not produced any real results. And, you know, what we did in our research was to sort of take a look at, you know, those types of collaborations that hadn't worked. And in many instances, things like public-private partnerships and funder collaboratives where foundations and companies might get together to pool their resources, and multi-stakeholder initiatives where, you know, you get citizens together and nonprofits and all different players, but they don't really have an agenda, that a lot of those collaborations haven't worked. So, you know, what we have, you know, seen is that there are certain conditions. And one of the conditions which you referenced is the backbone organization. That if you're going to get tens of hundreds of organizations around an issue like K through 12 education reform in Dallas to get on the same page, that you're going to need an organization that's going to basically need to really just coordinate that effort. And that's what we call a backbone organization.
I'm really curious, and I'm going to step aside just a minute from this discussion, about how you perform the research that tells you what's working and what isn't, given that, as you mentioned, a lot of organizations are all about sort of isolated impact studies. How do you sort of sift through, which is not to say that anyone's being dishonest, but how do you sift through the fact that a lot has been edited out of reporting when individual organizations are working in order to understand how they could have worked better if they had gone for collective impact?
Yeah. Well, what we've done is in our research is we've looked at those efforts where they've taken more of a collective impact approach. And, you know, they've defined a common agenda and they've defined common indicators. One of the examples we've researched and we talk about is the Strive Initiative, which is an initiative of over 300 cross-sector players in Cincinnati and northern Kentucky that have come together around what they call cradle-to-career education reform. And it's both the educational supports and the social supports that make that happen. Strive produces every year a report card. They're totally transparent in terms of the indicators that they've set out and how they're doing in terms of progress. For instance, their last report card said that they were looking at 54 indicators overall in terms of progress for the community, and they're making progress against 40 of those. So really, it's have they set out specific indicators of success, and then are they transparent in reporting progress against those?
How do you fold the for-profit sector into these efforts?
Yeah. So for-profit, from our perspective, is absolutely essential. And I think part of the challenge that, historically we've seen in the nonprofit sector is that often people from business, when they come in, assume that they can sort of impose their business-oriented ways and, see success. But I think, one of the most critical differences between the for-profit sector and the nonprofit sector, in business, if you're in a company and you want to make progress in terms of entering a new market, basically what you need to do is line up your salespeople, your marketing people, R&D, and sort of move in that direction. You need to get everybody in your company behind you, and that's a challenge. But if you're going to make progress against any of the serious social issues of our time, you need to enlist a whole set of stakeholders that are outside of your organization. And that's part of the things that business needs to understand. So business, coming into the social sector and into the nonprofit world, often has a learning curve, but they can also bring things. And one example would be in this initiative, this Cradle to Career initiative in Cincinnati and northern Kentucky. One of the just terrific things that the business community brought there was a disciplined approach to developing what are called evidence-based strategies around what works. So to actually sort of develop those strategies, whether or not it's around early childhood or around sort of access to college in Cincinnati, they actually went to GE and Procter & Gamble and were able to take advantage of what's called the Six Sigma process for sort of quality improvement. And that's
let me jump in here for a second. We got to take a quick break.
Sure.
My guest this hour is John Kenya. He's managing director of the nonprofit consulting firm FSG and co-author of the new book, Do More Than Give, The Six Practices of Donors Who Change the World. Join us at 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for THINK comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. You can enrich your career with new certificate programs in web design, graphic design, and paralegal studies. Learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to THINK on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Managing Director of the nonprofit consulting firm FSG, John Kania. He is co-author, along with Leslie Crutchfield and Mark Kramer, of the new book Do More Than Give, The Six Practices of Donors Who Change the World. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can call in now to 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org. So none of the examples that you have given me thus far sound like quick one-off, let's get this done in 8 months kinds of projects. How important are long-term commitments?
Long-term commitments are huge. I think one of the things that we all need to get used to when we think about making progress against education reform or against healthcare access, et cetera, is that there is this assumption out there that there are silver bullets. And I think one of our messages to people is that there may not be silver bullets, and in fact, there likely aren't in many instances. But we do have silver buckshot, to borrow a phrase from Al Gore. And by that I mean that if you sort of look at how societies have made progress over time, it's rare that sometimes you have scientific innovations, but often it's making progress on a lot of small fronts. So if you think about education, for example, you think about, children in early childhood falling behind because they take the summer off and coming up with a quote-unquote summer bridge program that helps with the kids. You think about what you can do with first-generation kids of first-generation going to college getting their families engaged in college prep activities. You think of what you can do in terms of, particular college access. There are a lot of different sort of small efforts that can be made, but those small efforts taken in total can make a big difference for a community. So you have to, I think, definitely take the long-term view here that this change is not going to happen quickly. That said, I think, you look at an initiative like I mentioned earlier, Strive, this education reform initiative in Cincinnati, and they're seeing very real progress in terms of improved graduation rates for high school, improved matriculation rates in college in about a 3 or 4 years time period. The thing is, thinking that you're going to do it in a year or two is pretty unrealistic.
Is that long-term commitment a harder sell to, say, individual philanthropists that who may not know sort of how much extra money they're going to have based on the way the markets are moving than it would be to the organizations that are performing the work itself?
Yeah. Well, ironically, it shouldn't be a hard sell to philanthropy. Philanthropy is the one sector of society that, most foundations are endowed and go on in perpetuity and give out 5% of the money that they have in a given year. And so philanthropy is the sector that should be able to think in a much more long-term way and to be able to take risks. And ironically, that often doesn't happen. But, to a certain extent, it's a bit of a hard sell to philanthropy, but it shouldn't be. And I think the more visionary philanthropists out there really understand that, it takes a while to create change.
It's interesting that you say take risks, because I think anyone in an entrepreneur knows that the only way you're going to really hit it big is to take some risks and be aware that failure is occasionally a risk. But it seems, is there a reluctance in the nonprofit sector? Is there the sense perhaps that this is donated money and it's meant to do something good, and if it doesn't, if it fails, then you've done something almost unethical?
Yeah, well, I think that has historically been a real issue in philanthropy, that on the one hand, they should be able to take risks. On the other hand, people are very reluctant to communicate when they failed. It's hard to say exactly why that is, except, historically, philanthropy in some respects, can be an ego-driven business. It shouldn't be. Mm-hmm. And I think the hardest part about it, and I think part of the reason that You know, failure is not something that is sort of widely communicated in philanthropy, is that it's been very hard to know historically whether or not, you know, organizations and efforts are making progress. It's just really hard to measure, you know, the individual impact of what your contributions are making. And given that, I think, you know, it's sort of like but measurement is getting better, and so there is an ability to actually get a sense of whether or not you are succeeding or failing. But imagine if you were 21 years old and you woke up and it was the first time you ever got a report card. You'd be kind of shy about sharing it with anybody, yeah, unless you got straight A's. And so I think that's what's going on in philanthropy. And for those that are down the path in terms of measuring the results and seeing how they do, they get a little bit more candid in terms of sharing their results.
John Kenya is my guest. He's managing director of the nonprofit consulting firm FSG and co-author of Do More Than Give, The 6 Practices of Donors Who Change the World. Join us at 1-800-933-5372 or via email to think@kera.org. Let's go now to Mary Beth in McKinney. Hi, Mary Beth.
Hi, good afternoon.
Hey.
I'm actually with the Texas Association of Nonprofit Organizations. We support all the nonprofits in Texas. And I was curious if what specific examples you may have in your book of nonprofits in Texas that are or philanthropists in Texas that are doing great things and making huge social changes.
Thanks for your call.
Yeah, Mary Beth. Well, that's a great question. You know, I don't know that we refer specifically to any initiatives in Texas. I'll talk about one right now that though that I think is sort of pretty cool and is in this collective impact arena, and that's the Texas High School Project. And it's really undergone a fairly interesting evolution from what was initially a public-private partnership, where the idea was, and this is sort of the historical model in philanthropy, is that certain philanthropies would raise up sort of great examples of success, and then the state government would fund it. So it was this public-private relationship between philanthropy and the state. And the Texas High School Project is you know, it's a bit of a misnomer because it actually is basically covers sort of strategies for education, middle school through post-secondary. You know, in this project, I think, you know, what became apparent over time was that while, you know, philanthropy was you know, a good source for these ideas, that, you know, the philanthropists themselves recognized that if they got a broader set of players involved, that they were probably going to get better ideas. And so they've moved more into this, you know, defining of a common agenda and inviting more players to the table, people like the Governor's Council and others, and are working in a much more collective and collaborative way. What's interesting is, on top of that, is they've thought about a collective agenda that's, you know, more broadly for Texas, and they've looked at what's been sort of driving poor post-secondary results in terms of graduation rates, et cetera. When they broke it down and sort of they looked at the issues, they then realized that in certain regions you had different issues, whether or not it was an urban area or a rural area, in terms of the strategies that you would employ. So they've taken a very collective approach, but they've gone a step further. And what we talk about in the book is that you got to be learn in order to change. And they had this fairly sort of macro aggregated point of view that they now need to break down and address by more individual community level, but still doing it in a cross-sector way and bringing those players together at a community level.
Another interesting thing that comes up in the book is this idea of empowering the individual. And I guess if you think about it like a pyramid, you know, you have the people who are benefiting from the work of different organizations at the very bottom. And then at the top, you have maybe administrators and above them, you have benefactors. What do the people at the sort of bottom rung understand about the effectiveness of a project or what is really needed that sometimes is a little bit harder to see from a couple floors up?
Yeah, well, I think the answer to that is they often don't understand. I think one of the movements, so one of our practices, we talk about 6 practices of donors who change the world, and one of the practices is that you need to empower individuals. And often what we find is policymakers, foundations, even nonprofits themselves, you know, develop these programs without really engaging individuals in the sort of the co-creation of the process. And what we're talking about is sort of, you know, getting residents and the people who, you know, have these challenging issues involved in actually developing results. You know, one of the examples we talk about in the book is the Jacobs Family Foundation, and their foundation and out in San Diego, and very interested in doing some community redevelopment in an area of San Diego that was basically sort of a browned out area, but yet you had a very sort of multicultural community living very near it. And, you know, they could have gone in and said, well, you know, in order to develop this community, you know, let's put in some housing and let's put, you know, let's fund some job skills, training organizations, et cetera. But what they did instead was to go to the community and say, well, what do you want? What could we use this area for? And what resulted is what's called the Market Cree Plaza, because when they went to individuals, you know, and this was pretty much of a low-income area, what they heard was, you know, not surprisingly, what they wanted was what middle-income people would want. They wanted a bank to they could walk to actually deposit their checks. So they wanted a grocery store where they could buy fresh food. And, you know, they wanted nice restaurants that they could take their family to. So what resulted from that actually going out to the folks who were actually affected by the issue was that they were able to actually you know, totally redeveloped this area. But interestingly enough, they created the first ever community development IPO. So The individuals actually live there were able to buy into ownership of this. And in addition, a lot of the businesses that were developed are locally owned.
What accounts for the reluctance? I mean, that asking the people that you want to serve makes perfect sense. Is there a belief maybe that you're opening Pandora's box and you're going to have a lot of requests that you can't possibly fulfill?
Yeah, you know, I think that's part of it. Part of it is, you know, just an assumption that, you know, individuals who have problems are not the ones, the experts mm-hmm. who have solutions. You know, there's a really interesting book recently published called The Power of Positive Deviance. And it's a great, great book to help you understand that often, you know, it's really the people who have the problem that need to solve the problem for themselves. And they've got some really great examples there. One of the co-authors is a guy named Jerry Sternin, and he was involved with Save the Children, and he went to Vietnam a number of years ago, and he was asked to, you know, basically address this issue of malnutrition in rural Vietnam. And when he went out there, you know, often what you'd find with, you know, and Save the Children is a great organization, is that they would bring a program that worked elsewhere. But what he did is he went out to the community and he looked for, you know, in a community that was severely malnourished, and he looked for examples, bright spots of where, you know, there were families that were actually doing something different with their kids and where they were sort of, you know, where they were well-nourished. And he actually, you know, he worked with folks within that community and asked them to go out and look for, you know, what was working. And what they found, interestingly enough, was very simple things, that there were certain families that typically, you know, families fed their kids, you know, basically rice and nothing more. But there were certain families that actually took from the dirt in the fields, they took crab and shrimp and they put in, you know, sweet potato, and their kids were that much better nourished. Mm-hmm. And it was something that nobody would have seen from the outside, but was developed sort of from, you know, from within. So, you know, this notion of the fact that, you know, the solutions need to come from experts who have figured out how something happens elsewhere is one that, you know, can be a dangerous one. I mean, it's good to learn what has worked elsewhere, but, you know, local context really matters a lot.
Is it harder than people outside the philanthropic world understand to actually define the problem in the first place?
Yeah. I think defining the problem is hugely challenging. I think, you know, you can think about, are we trying to address homelessness? Are we trying to address poverty reduction? And if we're trying to address homelessness, you know, what are the solutions to that? You know, there's a really great case example, and it's actually one we talk about in the book, about this issue of sort of defining the problem. And it's sort of a good news story, and it really, you know, identifies, I'll say in advance, the case of a foundation who really effectively learned from their work, but along the way they had to redefine their problem, and it's one that most people have heard of. It's the Gates Foundation. Mm-hmm. They started an initiative around homelessness, and, you know, Gates is located in the Pacific Northwest in Seattle, and they started an initiative in the year 2000 around ending homelessness in the Puget Sound area. It was called Sound Families, and it was a really great initiative, and they put a target out there that said they were going to build 1,500 affordable housing units and associated services and get those up really quickly, and within the course of 7 years they were actually able to achieve their goal, and they did a lot of good, and they got families back on their feet. But what they found when they sort of pulled back is that, you know, they had defined the issue fairly narrowly as, gee, homeless families need sort of transitional housing and, you know, a way to get back on their feet. Because during this initiative, while they had done a terrific job of getting more sort of transitional housing up, the homelessness rate in the Puget Sound area had actually increased. Mm. So they had to sort of step back and say, okay, what's happening? And, you know, they were able to sort of, through research, identify the fact that, you know, there were certain families that were on the brink of losing their homes but hadn't lost their homes, and they weren't eligible for services.
Right.
There were certain families that lived in one neighborhood but didn't have access to services in another area. There were certain families for whom housing was part of the issue, but they needed access to mental health services, being able to address domestic violence, et cetera. And then there were some families who were getting all sorts of services and didn't need as many. So what that told them was they were, you know, you had sort of a fairly dysfunctional system, in that if you stepped back and defined it less on the basis of transitional housing and more on the full compendium of services that people need who are in those dire circumstances, that, you know, that was a better way to define the problem, and they could help, you know, in this fairly collective way, start to bring together disparate players who were actually not communicating well.
So when clients come to you for consultation, have they already done a fair amount of research into the problem and the potential solutions themselves, or is that what they look to you for?
A lot of times that's what they look to us for. I think it really depends. You know, often we're working with foundations or nonprofits or businesses that have decided that they're interested in a particular issue, but they need to understand the problem. And I think, you know, particularly for the business sector, this is particularly vexing, because it's not their job, but yet they want to support certain social issues. And so how do they sort of get the level of research and depth and understanding of the issue?
My guest is John Kenya, Managing Director of the nonprofit consulting firm FSG. His new book is called Do More Than Give, The 6 Practices of Donors Who Change the World. Join the conversation now by calling in to 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. You can enrich your career with new certificate programs in web design, graphic design, and paralegal studies. Learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is John Kenya. He is co-author, along with Leslie Crutchfield and Mark Kramer, of the new book Do More Than Give, The 6 Practices of Donors Who Change the World. He's also managing director of the nonprofit consulting firm FSG. If you want to be part of the conversation, send an email to think@kera.org or call 1-800-933-5372. I want to talk for a minute about the skepticism that exists around for-profit companies that make large contributions to facilitate social change. The assumption by a lot of people, correctly or incorrectly, is that they're doing this for the good PR and they really don't care. What's your experience with that?
Well, I think there is a lot of that out there, and I think that, you know, historically has been the issue. I think, you know, what's the evolution around business and their engagement in social issues has been, in my mind, it's been a a one-way train, but it's been a slow train. But it's picking up speed in that businesses are starting to get a much better understanding of where society affects their, you know, their particular businesses, and where they can actually contribute. And businesses can bring a lot. You know, one of the examples we talk about in the book is GE, General Electric. You know, billion dollar you know, conglomerate worldwide, and some of the things that they've done, and things that they can do that, you know, really when you look at sort of progress that nonprofits can make, in some respects companies can make, you know, significantly more progress more quickly. An example would be for GE, they had this initiative in healthcare when they were interested in doing some good in Africa. And they said, you know, what we're going to do is we're going to try to bring our resources, our skills, and our expertise to solving a social problem. They looked in a variety of countries. They identified Ghana as an area that they were going to focus on, and they wanted to address healthcare. They picked a region of Ghana that had, you know, more than 100,000 people, but they the only healthcare they had was one midwife, literally in that area. So GE went ahead and said, okay, we're actually going to try to establish a hospital in the arena. And GE brought a lot to that. When you think about what it takes to, you know, put in a hospital, it's not just, you know, great doctors, but it takes, you know, electricity, it takes power generation, it takes water, it takes medical equipment. Those are all GE businesses. So GE said, okay, we want to go and we want to work with local stakeholders to actually put a hospital up, but we want, you know, local players to actually have skin in the game. So they worked, they got the Ministry of Health involved and got them to promise to bring a doctor. They got local tribal chieftains to work in terms of providing some of the sweat labor to actually build the hospital. And in a very short period of time, in the space of about 6 months, they were actually able to get a hospital up and running you know, is still high performing today. They've taken that basic model and they've been able to replicate that in, you know, more than a dozen sites in Africa and also now in Latin America and South America. And so you look at a company like that and you look at the resources that they can bring, they can make, you know, much quicker, arguably, you know, more profound progress because of their scale and because of their resources than you know, many in the social sector and sometimes even government. So, you know, I think that there is skepticism, and I think there are a lot of companies out there today that are still looking for the good PR. What we like to see is that companies will go on record as saying, here are the social outcomes, the health outcomes, the environmental outcomes, the educational outcomes that we're looking to put in place, and here's how we're contributing that goes sort of well beyond just our money.
Yeah, that corporate scale and areas of expertise is really interesting. I always think about the example of right after Hurricane Katrina, it was Walmart that got trucks of water in much faster than
right.
FEMA or anybody else, because that's what they do. They know
right.
how to get large shipments of goods from one place to another.
Right. And, you know, a number of years ago when we had the tsunami in Southeast Asia, there was a very interesting story about Pfizer wanting to contribute and going to the World Health Organization. And, you know, initially the World Health Organization said, well, you know, we don't want sort of a corporation coming in. And Pfizer said, well, we've got some really, you know, strong epidemiologists that we think can actually, you know, help and sort of add to what's going on the ground. And WHO said, well, we're still not sure we want a corporation in. And Pfizer said, we really want to be involved. We really want to bring our people that can make a difference on the ground. And WHO said, well, then, you know, send us the people you'll miss. Make sure we get your best people.
Mm-hmm. We know anecdotally that individual philanthropists can influence their friends and colleagues to take similar action. Does it work the same with corporations?
Yeah, I think it does. You know, I think there. What's interesting there? There's a club in Minneapolis, quote unquote club of corporations that are called the 5% Club. Minneapolis and Minnesota in general have been, you know, an incredibly from a corporate standpoint have been, you know, an incredibly generous philanthropic community. But very early on, some of the companies that were there basically said, we're going to, you know, we're going to go on record as saying we're going to donate 5% of our profits to nonprofit to charity. And in fact, you for that reason, you have this sort of it's not a club per se, but you know, you have a lot of companies in Minneapolis who basically have sort of signed on and said they do that. So yeah, I mean, I think it definitely, you know, companies can apply sort of peer pressure to their peers.
And then another thing that you mentioned that, you know, if really effective donors do is to leverage not only their financial resources, but the fact that they can pick up the phone and make a call and make something happen.
Yeah. And, you know, whatever the skills that they bring, you know, one of the stories we tell in the book is about Tan Siebel, who founded Siebel Systems, a big technology company, and, you know, a superb marketer. And he has a ranch in Montana. You know, at his ranch, he realized, you know, just, you know, the dire state of meth abuse happening in the state of Montana. And he decided he was going to do something about it. And, you know, obviously it was most rampant among teenagers. And Montana was like fifth in the country in terms of meth abuse. He said, well, this is something where we need to sort of change the behavior for teenagers. And they need to, you know, and the research showed that they didn't really have a sense of, you know, the addiction that would happen to him. So or happen to them. So he actually went ahead, because he's a marketing guy. He hired world-class advertising agencies to create this campaign that basically showed, kids, going from sort of wonderful kids to just being in an awful state and being totally addicted, and it was just a shocking campaign. But it did the trick in terms of sort of creating that awareness among kids. And Montana has now gone from being fifth worst to 39th, so more much more on the top of their game in terms of addressing this issue. So there's a case of a guy who. Didn't know a lot about the nonprofit sector, but saw the issue from a marketing standpoint and was able to bring that set of skills and capabilities.
You mentioned earlier that better tools are being developed to sort of measure effectiveness and outcomes. How is what we're doing today different than what we were doing a decade or two ago?
Well, you know, part of it's accumulated experience. I think, around the nature of sort of part of the biggest challenge in the nonprofit sector is comparability. And what we've seen and researched is that there are some really interesting examples using web-based tools and because of technology that have been developed where nonprofits can actually get a better sense of how they're doing in an inexpensive way, because often it's costly to evaluate, and B, that there's comparability both for themselves and for their funders. One example I'll mention is a success measures database, which is a set of tools that was developed for community development organizations to sort of track how they're doing, analyze how they're doing, and report how they're doing. And so it has basically, it was developed by folks in the community development field. It was funded by national foundations, and people said, okay, we've got these community development organizations, in different areas of the country, but we're all measuring the same thing, but we don't have the money to do it, and we don't have the resources and the tools, et cetera. So the group got together and they basically developed tools, things like surveys, and they developed indicators, 50 total indicators, and community development organizations can pick if they're only going to look at 10 of those indicators or all 50. And because this was funded, and it took multiple years, and it took several million dollars to be developed. Now you have a tool that any community development organization in the country can use, and it only costs them $2,500 a year to use it. And they get access to all these evaluative tools, and they're able to sort of enter their data and get sort of comparability relative to other community development organizations. So that's an example that we're just starting to see that. There's it was developed in Pennsylvania, but it's now in about seven states. The Cultural Data Project was an effort to basically for arts and cultural organizations sort of allow them to sort of, put their information into a system once as opposed to having to fill out all different grants applications. And what it does now is that allows funders who are funding those different arts and cultural organizations to basically look at those organizations in sort of an apples to apples way.
I guess one key difference between the for-profit and the not-for-profit sector is that when something's working in the not-for-profit world to affect social change, people are really usually happy to share as opposed to
right.
sort of really protecting those trade secrets. Are they getting better at developing ways to sort of broadcast what they're doing and also share where they learned from their own mistakes?
Yeah, and I think you'd find in the nonprofit sector that, you know, that's sort of the biggest clarion call from those that are doing the hard work on the ground is that we need to get a better sense of what works.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, I mean, it is the great thing about the nonprofit sector is that, to a great degree, people aren't proprietary and they do need to share what works. But it's hard to surface those lessons in a way that, can be broadly understood. I think that's a really great role for foundations. They often don't do it, but some of the best foundations at sharing knowledge are really great at sharing best practices. The Wallace Foundation, which is in New York, but actually does quite a bit of funding in Texas in the educational arena, is one of the best at sharing knowledge in the world. And so they've done a lot of work around areas like principal leadership, which is coming to the forefront as, you know, an issue in education. People are realizing, if we want great schools, we need great leaders, we need great principals. But there had, 10 years ago, there wasn't a lot of research about that. Wallace has done a ton of research. And if you go to their website, you'll see a lot of that research detailed. And that's the sort of activity that more foundations need to do. They need to share that sort of learning.
And the reason they haven't done it in the past is, does it feel to them initially like a distraction from whatever it is they're trying to achieve?
I think that's a good way to put it. I think typically foundations have looked at themselves as really sort of grant making organizations.
Mm-hmm.
But part of what we talk about in Do More Than Give is whether or not you're a foundation or an individual donor or a corporation, is that if we're going to address these complex issues of our time, we need to go beyond just giving. We need to engage the full resources of our organization. If we're a corporation, we need to engage with government around advocacy. And, a really critical thing, again, that funders can do because they have the luxury, the time, and the resources to do it is to, develop research around what's actually working and to be able to share that more broadly.
As a nonprofit consultant, who is your ideal client? And I don't mean specific client, but what do they bring to the table to work with you that makes them really ideal?
That's a great question. I think, a thirst for learning and a thirst for knowledge and, I heard this Peruvian proverb the other day, I actually used it in a talk this morning that I think is just wonderful. They have burning patience. They have burning patience because I think, any of these complex social issues that we're up against are going to take, they will take time to solve. But we need to be at them. We need to be intentional. And so our ideal client is somebody who wants to understand the complexity of the problem in all its complexity and is really willing to dig deep and recognizes that there are no simple answers, but recognizes that they can play a key role in terms of bringing about the conditions for change, that they can help back to, our initial topic today, sort of collective impact, that they can help create the conditions for different organizations with different values to come together to clarify their values, to work out their differences, and to develop that common agenda.
My guest this hour has been John Kenya. He is managing director of the nonprofit consulting firm FSG. He's also co-author of the new book, along with Leslie Crutchfield and Mark Kramer, called Do More Than Give, The Six Practices of Donors Who Change the World. John, it's been a really interesting discussion. Thank you so much for spending this hour with
Thank
us.
Thank you. It's been a lot of fun, Chris.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.
Think production team includes engineer Nilofer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.